Chapter 2, Europe's Downfall. 1. Europe and America. Over the heads of the European tribes, two mightier peoples regarded each other with increasing dislike. Well might they, for the one cherished the most ancient and refined of all surviving cultures, while the other, youngest and most self-confident of the great nations, proclaimed her novel spirit as the spirit of the future. In the Far East, China, already half-American, though largely Russian and wholly Eastern, patiently improved her rice lands, pushed forward her railways, organized her industries, and spoke fair to all the world. Long ago, during her attainment of unity and independence, China had learnt much from militant Bolshevism. And after the collapse of the Russian state, it was in the East that Russian culture continued to live. Its mysticism influenced India. Its social ideal influenced China. Not indeed that China took over the theory, still less the practice of communism, but she learnt to entrust herself increasingly to a vigorous, devoted, and despotic party, and to feel in terms of the social whole rather than individualistically. Yet she was honeycombed with individualism, and in spite of her rulers, she had precipitated a submerged and desperate class of wage slaves. In the Far West, the United States of America openly claimed to be custodians of the whole planet, universally feared and envied, universally respected for their enterprise, yet for their complacency very widely despised. The Americans were rapidly changing the whole character of man's existence. By this time, every human being throughout the planet made use of American products, and there was no region where American capital did not support local labor. Moreover, the American press, gramophone, radio, cinematograph, and televisor ceaselessly drenched the planet with American thought. Year by year, the ether reverberated with echoes of New York's pleasures and the religious fervors of the Middle West. What wonder, then, that America, even while she was despised, irresistibly molded the whole human race? This, perhaps, would not have mattered, had America been able to give of her very rare best. But inevitably, only her worst could be propagated. Only the most vulgar traits of that potentially great people could get through into the minds of foreigners by means of these crude instruments. And so, by the floods of poison issuing from this people's baser members, the whole world, and with it the nobler parts of America herself, were irrevocably corrupted. For the best of America was too weak to withstand the worst. Americans had indeed contributed amply to human thought. They had helped to emancipate philosophy from ancient fetters. They had served science by lavish and rigorous research. In astronomy, favored by their costly instruments and clear atmosphere, they had done much to reveal the dispositions of the stars and galaxies. In literature, though often they behaved as barbarians, they had also conceived new modes of expression and moods of thought not easily appreciated in Europe. They had also created a new and brilliant architecture, and their genius for organization worked upon a scale that was scarcely conceivable, let alone practicable to other peoples. In fact, their best minds faced old problems of theory and of valuation with a fresh innocence and courage, so that fogs of superstition were cleared away wherever these choice Americans were present. But these best were, after all, a minority in a huge wilderness of opinionated self-deceivers, in whom, surprisingly, an outworn religious dogma was championed with the intolerant optimism of youth. For this was essentially a race of bright but arrested adolescents. Something lacked which should have enabled them to grow up. One who looks back across the eons to this remote people can see their fate already woven of their circumstances and their disposition, and can appreciate the grim jest that these, who seemed to themselves gifted to rejuvenate the planet, should have plunged it inevitably through spiritual desolation into senility and age-long night. Inevitably. Yet here was a people of unique promise, gifted innately beyond all other peoples. Here was a race brood of all the races, and mentally more effervescent than any. Here were intermingled Anglo-Saxon stubbornness, Teutonic genius for detail and systematization,
Italian gaiety, the intense fire of Spain, and the more mobile Celtic flame. Here also was the sensitive and stormy Slav, a youth-giving Negroid infusion, a faint but subtly stimulating trace of the red man, and in the West a sprinkling of the Mongol. Mutual intolerance, no doubt, isolated these diverse stocks to some degree, yet the whole was increasingly one people, proud of its individuality, of its success, of its idealistic mission in the world, proud also of its optimistic and anthropocentric view of the universe. What might not this energy have achieved had it been more critically controlled, had it been forced to attend to life's more forbidding aspects? Direct tragic experience might perhaps have opened the hearts of this people. Intercourse with a more mature culture might have refined their intelligence. But the very success which had intoxicated them rendered them also too complacent to learn from less prosperous competitors. Yet there was a moment when this insularity promised to wane. So long as England was a serious economic rival, America inevitably regarded her with suspicion. But when England was seen to be definitely in economic decline, yet culturally still at her zenith, America conceived a more generous interest in the last and severest phase of English thought. Eminent Americans themselves began to whisper that perhaps their unrivaled prosperity was not after all good evidence either of their own spiritual greatness or of the moral rectitude of the universe. A minute but persistent school of writers began to affirm that America lacked self-criticism, was incapable of seeing the joke against herself, was in fact wholly devoid of that detachment and resignation which was the finest, though of course the rarest, mood of latter-day England. This movement might well have infused throughout the American people that which was needed to temper their barbarian egotism and open their ears once more to the silence beyond man's strident sphere. Once more, for only latterly had they been seriously deafened by the din of their own material success. And indeed, scattered over the continent throughout this whole period, many shrinking islands of true culture contrived to keep their heads above the rising tide of vulgarity and superstition. These it was that had looked to Europe for help, and were attempting a rally when England and France blundered into that orgy of emotionalism and murder which exterminated so many of their best minds and permanently weakened their cultural influence. Subsequently, it was Germany that spoke for Europe, and Germany was too serious an economic rival for America to be open to her influence. Moreover, German criticism, though often emphatic, was too heavily pedantic, too little ironical, to pierce the hide of American complacency. Thus it was that America sank further and further into Americanism. Vast wealth and industry, and also brilliant invention, were concentrated upon puerile ends. In particular, the whole of American life was organized around the cult of the powerful individual, that phantom ideal which Europe herself had only begun to outgrow in her last phase. Those Americans who wholly failed to realize this ideal, who remained at the bottom of the social ladder, either consoled themselves with hopes for the future, or stole symbolical satisfaction by identifying themselves with some popular star, or gloated upon their American citizenship and applauded the arrogant foreign policy of their government. Those who achieved power were satisfied so long as they could merely retain it, and advertised it uncritically in the conventionally self-assertive manner. It was almost inevitable that when Europe had recovered from the Russo-German disaster, she should come to blows with America, for she had long chafed under the saddle of American finance, and the daily life of Europeans had become more and more cramped by the presence of a widespread and contemptuous foreign aristocracy of American businessmen. Germany alone was comparatively free from this domination, for Germany was herself still a great economic power. But in Germany, no less than elsewhere, there was constant friction with the Americans. Of course, neither Europe nor America desired war. Each was well aware that war would mean the end of business prosperity, and for Europe, very possibly the end of all things. For it was known that man's power of destruction had recently increased, and that if war were raged relentlessly, the stronger side might exterminate the other. But inevitably, an incident at last occurred which roused blind rage on each side of the Atlantic. A murder in South Italy, a few ill-considered remarks in the European press, offensive retaliation in the American press accompanied by the lynching of an Italian in the Middle West, an uncontrollable massacre of American citizens in Rome, the dispatch of an American air fleet to occupy Italy, interception by the European air fleet, and war was in existence before ever it had been declared. This aerial action resulted, perhaps unfortunately for Europe, in a momentary check to the American advance. The enemy was put on his mettle and prepared a crushing blow. 2. The Origins of a Mystery. While the Americans were mobilizing their whole armament, there occurred the really interesting event of the war. It so happened that an international society of scientific workers was meeting in England at Plymouth, and the young Chinese physicist had expressed his desire to make a report to a select committee. As he had been experimenting to find means for the utilization of subatomic energy by the annihilation of matter, it was with some excitement that, according to instruction, the 40 international representatives traveled to the north coast of Devon and met upon the bare headland called Hartland Point. It was a bright morning after rain. 11 miles to the northwest, the cliffs of Lundy Island displayed their markings with unusual detail. Seabirds wheeled about the heads of the party as they seated themselves on their raincoats in a cluster upon the rabbit-cropped turf. They were a remarkable company, each one of them a unique person, yet characterized to some extent by his particular national type. And all were distinctively scientists of the period. Formerly, this would have implied a rather uncritical leaning towards materialism and an affectation of cynicism, but by now it was fashionable to profess an equally uncritical belief that all natural phenomena were manifestations of the cosmic mind. In both periods, when a man passed beyond the sphere of his own serious scientific work, he chose his beliefs irresponsibly, according to his taste, much as he chose his recreation or his food. Of the individuals present, we may single out one or two for notice. The German, an anthropologist, and a product of the long-established cult of physical and mental health, sought to display in his own athletic person the characters proper to Nordic man. The Frenchman, an old but still sparkling psychologist, whose queer hobby was the collecting of weapons, ancient and modern, regarded the proceedings with kindly cynicism. The Englishman, one of the few remaining intellectuals of his race, compensated for the severe study of physics by a scarcely less devoted research into the history of English expletives and slang, delighting to treat his colleagues to the fruits of his toil. The West African president of the society was a biologist, famous for his interbreeding of man and ape. When all were settled, the president explained the purpose of the meeting. The utilization of subatomic energy had indeed been achieved, and they were to be given a demonstration. The young Mongols stood up and produced from a case an instrument rather like the old-fashioned rifle. Displaying this object, he spoke as follows, with that quaintly stilted formality which had once been characteristic of all educated Chinese. Before describing the details of my rather delicate process, I will illustrate its importance by showing what can be done with a finished product. Not only can I initiate the annihilation of matter, but also I can do so at a distance and in a precise direction. Moreover, I can inhibit the process. As a means of destruction, my instrument is perfect. As a source of power for the constructive work of mankind, it has unlimited potentiality. Gentlemen, this is a great moment in the history of man. I am about to render into the hands of organized intelligence the means to stop forever man's internecine brawls. Henceforth, this great society, of which you are the elite, will beneficently rule the planet. With this little instrument, you will stop the ridiculous war, and with another, which I shall soon perfect, you will dispense unlimited industrial power, wherever you consider it needed. Gentlemen, with the aid of this handy instrument which I have the honor to demonstrate, you are about to become absolute masters of this planet. Here the representative of England muttered an archaism whose significance was known only to himself. God help us! In the minds of some of those foreigners who were not physicists, this quaint expression was taken to be a technical word having some connection with the new source of energy. The Mongol continued. Turning towards Lundy, he said, "That island is no longer inhabited, and as it is something of a danger to shipping, I will remove it." So saying, he aimed his instrument at the distant cliff, but continued speaking. "This trigger will stimulate the ultimate positive and negative charges which constitute the atoms at a certain point on the rock face to annihilate each other. These stimulated atoms will infect their neighbors, and so on indefinitely. This second trigger, however, will stop the actual annihilation. Were I to refrain from using it, the process would indeed continue indefinitely, perhaps until the whole of the planet had disintegrated." There was an anxious movement among the spectators, but the young man took careful aim and pressed the two triggers in quick succession. No sound from the instrument, no visible effect upon the smiling face of the island. Laughter began to gurgle from the Englishman, but ceased, for a dazzling point of light appeared on the remote cliff. It increased in size and brilliance till all eyes were blinded in the effort to continue watching. It lit up the underparts of the clouds and blotted out the sun-cast shadows of gorse bushes beside the spectators. The whole end of the island facing the mainland was now an intolerable scorching sun. Presently, however, its fury was veiled in clouds of steam from the boiling sea. Then suddenly, the whole island, 3 miles of solid granite, leapt asunder, so that a covey of great rocks soared heavenwards, and beneath them swelled more slowly a gigantic mushroom of steam and debris. Then the sound arrived. All hands were clapped to ears, while eyes still strained to watch the bay, pocked white with the hail of rocks. Meanwhile, a great wall of sea advanced from the center of turmoil. This was seen to engulf a coasting vessel and pass on towards Bideford and Barnstaple. The spectators leaped to their feet and clamored, while the young author of this fury watched the spectacle with exultation and some surprise at the magnitude of these mere after-effects of his process. The meeting was now adjourned to a neighboring chapel to hear the report of the research. As the representatives were filing through the door, it was observed that the steam and smoke had cleared, and that open sea extended where had been Lundy. Within the chapel, the great Bible was decorously removed and the windows thrown open to dispel somewhat the odor of sanctity. But though the early and spiritual interpretations of relativity and the quantum theory had by now accustomed men of science to pay their respects to the religions, many of them were still liable to a certain asphyxia when they were actually within the precincts of sanctity. When the scientists had settled themselves upon the archaic and unyielding benches, the president explained that the chapel authorities had kindly permitted this meeting because they realized that, since men of science had gradually discovered the spiritual foundation of physics, science and religion must henceforth be close allies. Moreover, the purpose of this meeting was to discuss one of those supreme mysteries which it was the glory of science to discover and religion to transfigure. The president then complimented the young dispenser of power upon his triumph and called upon him to address the meeting. At this point, however, the aged representative of France intervened and was granted a hearing. Born almost 140 years earlier and preserved more by native intensity of spirit than by the artifices of the regenerator, this ancient seemed to speak out of a remote and wiser epoch. For in a declining civilization, it is often the old who see furthest and see with youngest eyes. He concluded a rather long, rhetorical, yet closely reasoned speech as follows. "No doubt we are the intelligence of the planet, and because of our consecration to our calling, no doubt we are comparatively honest, But alas, even we are human. We make little mistakes now and then, and commit little indiscretions. The possession of such power as is offered us would not bring peace. On the contrary, it would perpetuate our national hates. It would throw the world into confusion. It would undermine our own integrity and turn us into tyrants. Moreover, it would ruin science. And, well, when at last through some little error the world got blown up, the disaster would not be regrettable. I know that Europe is almost certainly about to be destroyed by those vigorous but rather spoilt children across the Atlantic. But distressing as this must be, the alternative is far worse. No, sir. Your very wonderful toy would be a gift for developed minds. But for us, who are still barbarians, no, it must not be. And so, with deep regret, I beg you to destroy your handiwork. And, if it were possible, your memory of your marvelous research. But above all, breathe no word of your process to us, or to any man. The German then protested that to refuse would be cowardly. He briefly described his vision of a world organized under organized science, and inspired by a scientifically organized religious dogma. Surely, he said, to refuse were to refuse the gift of God, of that God whose presence in the humblest quantum we have so recently and so surprisingly revealed. Other speakers followed, for and against. But it soon grew clear that wisdom would prevail. Men of science were by now definitely cosmopolitan in sentiment. Indeed, so far were they from nationalism, that on this occasion the representative of America had urged acceptance of the weapon, although it would be used against his own countrymen. Finally, however, and actually by a unanimous vote, the meeting, while recording its deep respect for the Chinese scientists, requested, nay, ordered, that the instrument and all account of it should be destroyed. The young man rose, drew his handiwork from its case, and fingered it. So long did he remain thus standing in silence, with eyes fixed on the instrument, that the meeting became restless. At last, however, he spoke. "I shall abide by the decision of the meeting. Well, it is hard to destroy the fruit of 10 years' work, and such fruit, too. I expected to have the gratitude of mankind, but instead I am an outcast." Once more he paused. Gazing out of the window, he now drew from his pocket a field glass and studied the western sky. "Yes, they are American. Gentlemen, the American air fleet approaches." The company leapt to its feet and crowded to the windows. High in the west, a sparse line of dots stretched indefinitely into the north and the south. Said the Englishman, "For God's sake, use your damn tool once more, or England's done. They must have smashed our fellows over the Atlantic." The Chinese scientist turned his eyes on the president. There was a general cry of, "Stop them!" Only the Frenchman protested. The representative of the United States raised his voice and said, "They are my people. I have friends up there in the sky. My own boy is probably there. But they're mad. They want to do something hideous. They're in the lynching mood. Stop them!" The Mongol still gazed at the president, who nodded. The Frenchman broke down in sennel tears. Then the young man, leaning upon the windowsill, took careful aim at each black dot in turn. One by one, each became a blinding star, then vanished. In the chapel, a long silence. Then whispers, and glances at the Chinese scientist, expressive of anxiety and dislike. There followed a hurried ceremony in a neighboring field. A fire was lit. The instrument and the no less murderous manuscript were burnt. And then the grave young Mongol, having insisted on shaking hands all round, said, "With my secret alive in me, I must not live. Some day a more worthy race will rediscover it, but today I am a danger to the planet. And so I, who have foolishly ignored that I live among savages, help myself now by the ancient wisdom to pass hence." So saying, he fell dead. 3. Europe Murdered. Rumors spread by voice and radio throughout the world. An island had been mysteriously exploded. The American fleet had been mysteriously annihilated in the air. And in the neighborhood where these events had occurred, distinguished scientists were gathered in conference. The European government sought out the unknown savior of Europe to thank him and secure his process for their own use. The president of the Scientific Society gave an account of the meeting and the unanimous vote. He and his colleagues were promptly arrested, and pressure, first moral and then physical, was brought to bear on them to make them disclose the secret. For the world was convinced that they really knew it, and were holding it back for their own purposes. Meanwhile, it was learnt that the American air commander, after he had defeated the European fleet, had been instructed merely to demonstrate above England while peace was negotiated. For in America, big business had threatened the government with boycott if unnecessary violence were committed in Europe. Big business was by now very largely international in sentiment, and it was realized that the destruction of Europe would inevitably unhinge American finance. But the unprecedented disaster to the victorious fleet roused the Americans to blind hate, and the peace party was submerged. Thus it turned out that the Chinese scientists' one hostile act had not saved England, but doomed her. For some days, Europeans lived in panic dread, knowing not what horror might at any moment descend on them. No wonder, then, that the government resorted to torture in order to extract the secret from the scientists. No wonder that, out of the 40 individuals concerned, one, the Englishman, saved himself by deceit. He promised to do his best to remember the intricate process. Under strict supervision, he used his own knowledge of physics to experiment in search of the Chinese trick. Fortunately, however, he was on the wrong scent, and indeed he knew it. For though his first motive was mere self-preservation, later he conceived the policy of indefinitely preventing the dangerous discovery by directing research along a blind alley. And so his treason, by seeming to give the authority of a most eminent physicist to a wholly barren line of research, saved this undisciplined and scarcely human race from destroying its planet. The American people, sometimes tender even to excess, were now collectively insane with hate of the English and of all Europeans. With cold efficiency, they flooded Europe with the latest and deadliest of gases till all the peoples were poisoned in their cities like rats in their holes. The gas employed was such that its potency would cease within 3 days. It was therefore possible for an American sanitary force to take charge of each metropolis within a week after the attack. Of those who first descended into the great silence of the murdered cities, many were unhinged by the overwhelming presence of dead populations. The gas had operated first upon the ground level, but rising like a tide, it had engulfed the top stories, the spires, the hills. Thus, while in the streets lay thousands who had been overcome by the first waves of poison, every roof and pinnacle bore the bodies of those who had struggled upwards in the vain hope of escaping beyond the highest reach of the tide. When the invaders arrived, they beheld on every height prostrate and contorted figures. Thus Europe died. All centers of intellectual life were blotted out. And of the agricultural regions, only the uplands and mountains were untouched. The spirit of Europe lived henceforth only in a piecemeal and dislocated manner in the minds of Americans, Chinese, Indians, and the rest. There were indeed the British colonies, but they were by now far less European than American. The war had, of course, disintegrated the British Empire. Canada sided with the United States. South Africa and India declared their neutrality at the outbreak of war. Australia, not through cowardice, but through conflict of loyalties, was soon reduced to neutrality. The New Zealanders took to their mountains and maintained an insane but heroic resistance for a year. A simple and gallant folk, they had almost no conception of the European spirit. yet obscurely and in spite of their Americanization, they were loyal to it, or at least to that symbol of one aspect of Europeanism, England. Indeed, so extravagantly loyal were they, or so innately dogged and opinionated, that when further resistance became impossible, many of them, both men and women, killed themselves rather than submit. But the most lasting agony of this war was suffered not by the defeated, but by the victors. For when their passion had cooled, the Americans could not easily disguise from themselves that they had committed murder. They were not at heart a brutal folk, but rather a kindly. They liked to think of the world as a place of innocent pleasure-seeking, and of themselves as the main purveyors of delight. Yet they had been somehow drawn into this fantastic crime, and henceforth an all-pervading sense of collective guilt warped the American mind. They had ever been vainglorious and intolerant, but now these qualities in them became extravagant, even to insanity. Both as individuals and collectively, they became increasingly frightened of criticism, increasingly prone to blame and hate, increasingly self-righteous, increasingly hostile to the critical intelligence, increasingly superstitious. Thus was this once noble people singled out by the gods to be cursed, and the minister of curses.